There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the deal we got? I mean, the deal we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
All right, here we go. FM Talk 106.5 at Midday Mobile Live this Friday from the Mobile Boat Show. Or if those are too loud, I will adjust that down just a little bit. I can't see it. Is that a little better? I'm sorry. I'm engineering and doing the show at the same time. Dalton, if you can help out there. It's a lot to do at one time. We are live at the Mobile Boat Show, and Dan Miller from Gulf Coast Shows is in here. And we're talking about, number one, what's happening today, tomorrow, and Sunday as the doors have opened up here at the Mobile Boat Show. And we'd love you to come by and be part of this. They got you squared away over there? You good? All right, that's good. So we got you loud and clear. The voice of the Mobile Boat Show, Dan Miller, thanks for having us back. Thanks for having the Guide's Corner back out here.
Oh, listen, we're great. It's such a great thing to have people be able to come up, talk to the guides, and ask any kind of question they want to ask. You know,
yeah, usually about fishing, but sometimes it's...
you could ask somebody about the latest hunt trip.
That's right, because we got that crosser, and we actually have some people from the hunting world here, too. But I know if I'm giving you all a heads up, if you're heading this way, I just saw Captain Wayne Miller, who is a Delta bass fishing phenom, just walked in. He's here, so if you are waiting to see Captain Wayne Miller, he is already here, so make sure to stop on by. I want to ask you this. So this year... Show Friday, Saturday, Sunday. We've right. got a sea of fiberglass in there.
Oh,
we got a sea of fiberglass outside. It looks like things are popping upstairs. The vent are there. There are like more things for your boat this year. I mean, there's a bunch of boats, but the stuff. If you say I already got the boat, but I'm looking for electronics or accessories. I mean, y'all've got a lot of vendors.
Oh, there really are. You know, more than we've ever had. I think I've counted. Four people who have electronics of, you know, just kind of anything in the world you could possibly want.
I mean, and they're about like computers. So each year there's a bigger, better.
Bigger, better. No question about it.
I mean, if you in the electronics world, if your stuff is two or three years old on your boat, you're way behind the times.
You're way behind. I guess some of them now have a little diver that'll go down and catch the fish for it next. I don't know. It's crazy.
Hey, talking about growing. How many years have you been doing this?
Well, it was started in 1952 by John Damrich and Jack Dries, who was a local sportscaster, actually a national sportscaster anyway. I got involved in 1991, so I've done it since then. So 20 how many years?
Yes, you've seen some growth in this.
I really have. You know, I started out in the old Civic Center, and we came here as soon as it was built.
Right.
And it's really grown. You know, it's probably the largest show on the Gulf Coast, anywhere between Texas and Tampa.
That's saying something, because this is boat country.
Oh, boy.
I mean, this is boat country. So when you say you're the biggest in that area, there's lots of people that are thinking about boats. And you get people travel, and I've now met them over the years we've been working together, that travel a good distance. Even though you have show in Biloxi, there's people travel distance to come here to this show.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We'll have... I mean, people from New Orleans will be here, Dothan, Montgomery. This is really a regional kind of show, more so than anybody else. You know, you could go to Birmingham, has a boat show, but if you fish the saltwater, do anything around saltwater, this is the place to be.
But I wonder if that's why this show is so much bigger than the others, because you have a full suite of the saltwater boats, offshore boats, and inshore boats. At the same time, I'm looking right out our window here, duck hunting boats. To bass fishing boats, to the crappie fishing boats, to kayak. I mean, they kind of all meet here, literally, with the water and the vendors.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, we're fortunate in Mobile. We can fish the bay. We can fish the Gulf. We can fish up in the rivers. It's just an amazing resource that we have here in Mobile. It really is.
What do you see in trends over this time with the boats? I mean... more of something than something else? What do you see?
Well, I've seen more pontoon boats and leisure kind of boats in the last several years. You know, as some of our population, I won't mention who, gets a little older, you slow down a little bit. Fortunately,
you can load some grandkids on a pontoon boat.
You absolutely can, and there's some gorgeous pontoon boats here.
Days of them just being like a deck on top of two pontoons, that's changed.
That's a thing of the past. I think if you wanted to ski behind them, you could do that now. Absolutely.
They get up and move.
Oh, yeah, they will really go.
All right, let's talk about, as we talk about the family, you've always done a great job, too. If we have the boats to look at, we have the accessories, we have the electronics, but you got stuff going on for the whole family. My children come each year, and they're never bored.
Oh, you won't be bored. No, you know, it's starting out with being able to catch a fish. You know, little kids can...
Not fishing, you're catching up
there.
You're
catching. Yeah. You're really catching fish. And then the touch tanks that the Alabama Marine Resources has, it's just amazing to be able to touch... starfish and stingrays and
little flounder,
kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then we've got the fabulous dog show that we've always had, and we'll just, he's the kind of the hit of the show. You want to make sure you time your visit or stay long enough to see that.
Now, and I double and triple down on what you're saying. I think they're highly, for the big kids like me and for my children, we all love it. The whole family loves it. They can see Fetch and Fish Dog Show on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, right? But there are certain posted times.
Certain posted times, yeah. And you want to check and make sure you come for those times.
Yes.
So you won't miss it. And by the way, don't forget to mention the Kids Fishing 101.
Yes, now this is something I was introduced to last year and actually took my son to be part of it. And I saw Captain Ronnie just a second ago, and he and I were talking about it. This is coming up tomorrow. Coming up tomorrow at 1 o'clock, right,
that's
on
correct.
Saturday. So we came home with a lot of fun from this, plus my son built his own popping cork and everything last year. They got to do, like, fishing crafts, for lack of a better word. It was well received by, and he was 7 last year, y'all, if you're planning. He's 8 this year and looking forward to it. That, he was a big fan of it.
Big fan. That's perfect time for him.
So this is going to be going on tomorrow. So what if somebody wants to do this, they just, because I know Ronnie's here, but they do they have to sign up ahead of time, or can they just come right in tomorrow?
Come up, and I think they'll get a ticket and have to wait their turn.
Right.
Because I was...
Oh, we also got a rod reel tackle box.
Yeah.
Out of that, too.
Sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Rod and reel, tackle box. You learn about safety, water safety. I think there are about 8 stations, and each kid will go to each station and learn a different thing at each place.
All right, and this is happening at 1 o'clock tomorrow. So doors open earlier, but if people are trying to plan a family schedule tomorrow,
exactly.
1 o'clock, be here for this.
Be here for that.
All right, let's talk about tickets. Let's talk about where – you're going to get mad at me. Where would you like – where's the best place to park?
Best place to park probably is the CSX lot right next door. But,
okay.
You know, on weekends in Mobile, there are – thousands of places you can park downtown,
right.
Just like there are for Mardi Gras.
Right.
And we've seen there's a big city parking garage right across the street.
You can walk right across, yeah.
Walk right over from there. Won't fight the traffic. But there are many, many places to park in downtown Mobile.
All right. And tickets available here at the boat show.
At the show, absolutely. And the tickets are $10. Kids 15 and under are free.
That worked for my family.
Yeah, so if you're not driving, you can get it as long as you bring your family.
that's a good deal. That helps us a whole bunch.
Bring your mom or dad.
Yes. But seriously, because there is a whole bunch to look at and be part of. And you and I are going to talk some more here. And I know we'll be talking tomorrow when we do a special 2-hour live outdoor show here. And as always, thanks for having us back out. Thanks for being a gracious host for the Guides Corner.
Always glad to have you.
All right, it's Dan Miller. I tell you what, why don't you hold off on running the break, because I do want to check in. I want to check in with Angelo from Mobile Bay Coins, because I know he is on, and I want to talk to him in time to get him to come down here and look at some boats with me. Hey, Angelo.
Hey, Sean. How you doing?
Doing good. So, you know, we talked about this last year, a two-part thing. So if I may or may not be purchasing an expensive edition for one of our boats, I make them our boats now because it's boat show time, my boat. If I'm making an expensive addition to the boat, I need to stop by and see you to have something to gift at the same time.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we highly recommend that. And not only that, make sure that you speak to her before that item either arrives in your driveway or before the bill arrives, you know, what's going on. So, yeah, we would highly recommend you come by Mobile Bay Coins. We're just down the road on Government Street, not far away at all. And we just got a bunch of really nice diamond earrings in, all sorts of cool things.
Right. So, and then we could even call the boat Diamond in the Rough or something like that, and then bring the diamond with it. I think we're working out a plan here. But honest goodness, whether you're buying a new boat here at the show, or you had forgotten that next week is Valentine's Day, gentlemen.
Oh, yeah, there's that.
Gentlemen, get ready and watch what's happening at Mobile Bay Coins. So you talked about diamonds. Also, I mean, you've got a kind of a variety here depending on budget. You've got something for us to pick up for Valentine's Day.
We certainly do. Everything from $15, $16 all the way up to thousands of dollars, depending on what your budget is or how badly you've blown your budget at the boat show. We can help you out either way.
All right. Well, that's good. Give us directions to come see you. Coming or going to the boat show, we'll be coming right by your store. So how we get there?
Yeah, we're in Midtown, 2204 Government Street. In the evening before, you can always check us out online, either on Facebook or at MobileBayCoins.com.
All right, great stuff, Angelo. We'll talk soon.
Have a good one, Sean.
All right, see you down here. Angelo checking in from Mobile Bay Coins, and we'll go to the news break, and coming right back, Ben Raines is going to join us. Do you see a story this week? They have found a canal hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years old in South Baldwin County. Yeah, like a canal connecting Oyster Bay with Little Lagoon. And no, it wasn't built by the Corps of Engineers. It was built by Native Americans by hand. Wait till you hear about this. We're coming right back.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5, and it is Midday Mobile live from the Mobile Boat Show. Hey, we're going to be here for a lot longer than the show. So the show's over at 2, Feinbaum comes on, but we'll be here going throughout the afternoon and then tomorrow and Sunday, all with the Guides Corner. You get here to the boat show, you come down the escalators, and you hang that left here at the convention center, the straightaway run to the big room where all the boats are. Well, you'll see us right across from Alabama Marine Resources and the touch tank and all that. And it's actually pretty cool because looking at a falcon right now. So live birds of prey here. Maybe we can, they'll get mad if we get one of those furs over there. You see those furs they have on the table? If we put one on a string and drag it around here and see if we can get the birds of prey to do some hunting here at the event. I'd love to see you. Come on down. We'll be here throughout the evening tomorrow and Sunday. Hope to see my buddy Ben Raines here as well. He's with AL.com and he joins us now on Midday Mobile. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Sean, how you doing?
Doing good, doing good. I'm looking at the falcon and getting to hang out with folks and talk fishing and talk with you. I think it's a pretty good afternoon.
Yeah, and you were already coming up with a way to taunt the falcon. I like it.
Yes, come on. Eternally, I'm going to be a 12-year-old boy. I can't help it. I tell you what, you're reporting so many stories are so fascinating to me. How you keep uncovering these kind of things, but uncovering you do. And this one, this week, I got fired up early on when you present a story about a canal, old canal, not like, you know, usually we're talking about, yeah, it's an old canal from the 1950s. They haven't kept up. This is a canal that was dug when?
It was dug in about 600. So a little earlier than the 50s, about 1,400 years ago.
And the 1,400 year old canal
in Gulf Shores had been pestering the University of South Alabama about it. And so Greg Wasselkov, the head archaeologist over there, took his crew out and they went to this depression that the locals were talking about, and sure enough, it turned out to be an ancient travel canal.
You know what's fascinating to me about this is reading your story and then having heard those stories in the past, and then since your story came out, having people from South Baldwin in that area reinforce when folklore is confirmed by science. I don't know. I get a warm and fuzzy about it because, things that I really enjoy. And so many people had always talked about the Indian mounds and the Indian ditch down in South Baldwin, and that turns out to be how we, you know, it was part of folklore, but we hadn't codified it anywhere or hadn't been written down that there was this canal. I don't know, but thank goodness we did it now. This is fascinating. Talk to me about what was the process, the why, the how big of this canal. What's the story?
Well, so let's start with the why. You know, if you look at a map of Baldwin County, you want to get to the Gulf, you from, say, Weeks Bay or Fairhope or anywhere along the eastern shore, you've got to go all the way to the end of the Fort Morgan Peninsula, which is a 20-mile-long peninsula. So what the Indians had, there were two big bodies of water already there with Oyster Bay, which was right at the mouth of the Bonsecours River. Of course, the Intracoastal Canal wasn't there. So they connected Oyster Bay to Little Lagoon, and then they could travel to the Gulf. They'd paddle, you know, 3 or 4 miles instead of 20 miles. And they were in protected water the whole way instead of the open bay.
And so this is a narrow point. This was the I guess, Pleasure Island equivalent of the Isthmus of Panama, right? I mean, this was the...
Right.
to connect from one waterway to another.
But so and wonder if there wasn't some sort of connection there already, some sort of, you know, just even a little tiny creek or cut or something, a drain, and maybe they expanded that. I don't know. Or they dug the whole thing.
I would imagine it would be the former. I mean, because, but I mean, I'm absolutely just guessing. But without mechanized power, let alone, and I want to get into some of your reporting on what kind of tools they might have had. But without modern, even modern hand tools, let alone mechanized power, it seems like you would absolutely pick the least path, the path of least resistance. I mean, if there was a trickle of water, it would have been a preferential sign to somewhere where you had to do just a little more work to make it happen.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It would have kept things wet. You know how wet sand is. It's a lot easier to dig. But, you know, they had all kinds of tools. One of the things that the tribes in our area traded with other tribes was seashells. You know, and I'm a big diver and all. Our beaches are picked pretty clean today of shells. But imagine back then when there were no shell hunters around except, you know, the Indians. You know, I've got whelk shells that I found down around Perdido Pass. Now, you know, a lightning whelk is this big, long snail, basically. And these shells are so big, you can put them on your head as a hat. That's how big the opening is in this shell. It would have been a great digging tool, you know?
I hadn't thought about that. So you had... So was it... I mean, because you talked about the trading that Native American cultures from here were doing, even... Now, not saying they had a direct trading route, but from hand to hand, there were things like obsidian or things from the northwest United States that had made it down here.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that period, you know, it seems like people were a lot friendlier with each other as far as the tribes go than what we hear about in, you know, the movies and everything. And certainly they had wars and war periods, but that period was supposed to be pretty peaceful across the country. And I guess, you know, maybe there were plenty of resources and no guns, so that would have helped too.
Well, I mean, yeah, there was warring. I mean, the warring was just a part of life. If you the books I've read, but you're talking about the woodland period versus. I mean, how is this lay in? Tell folks how this lays in with the Indian mounds, like at Bottle Creek and all that. Is this the same time period? Same hundreds
of
years?
So Bottle Creek is about 700 years later. And the archaeologists are unsure if the tribes were even connected. You know, if they were, it may have been a whole new culture. The Bottle Creek period is called the Mississippian culture, which they now realize should have been called the Mobilian culture, based on Mound Island. That was actually the capital. And the Mound culture, you know, the Moundville up around Tuscaloosa, is the same tribe and culture as the mounds we have down here in the Delta. And so this was the capital, and it stretched over toward Pearl River in Mississippi, and then over toward Pensacola. So if your sacred fire went out in one of these other places, you had to come to Mound Island in the Delta to get new sacred fire. Then imagine paddling your dugout canoe home with these embers you've got to keep going. And then all of a sudden having this canal, and imagine they had other canals around, these shortcuts they had built. What a boon that would have been, you know, whether you were going to get food. I mean, imagine you went to get oysters for your family for dinner, and you could paddle 4 miles instead of 40 miles, and you didn't have to carry the oysters, you know, which is basically like hauling rocks. So, you know, this canal would have been such a labor-saving thing. I think they would have really, you know, like a superhighway.
It would have been worth it dramatically. Yeah, it would have been worth the energy exerted to build it. I mean, that, you know, those judgments probably were... made because you only had so much energy and so many hours in the day, and work took a lot of energy and time out of your day. So, yeah, you had to be they didn't just build it to build it, right? It wasn't an edifice to mankind. It really actually had to do something. Okay,
They did build a lot of things like that. They did
the mounds,
build,
right?
You know, tomb burial mounds and stuff, but this was different. This was a highway. They were making themselves a road to make life easier.
Let's talk about, too, you mentioned the oysters. I mean, that's got to be part of this motivation, the shortcut, because not only oysters, but, I mean, that gets them to the Gulf and the number of resources. If they were maybe living in some kind of, you know, living up along Bon Secours or something like that, you had a lot more food out there by the Gulf.
Exactly. And different times of the year as well. And, of course, you know, being on the Gulf in the wintertime would be lousy. It'd be cold and wet and windy. So being able to retreat inland to where they could have high ground and be protected from storms and all would have been really important. I went to the spot, the mouth of the canal, where it hits Little Lagoon. And as soon as I walked up there, there were two crabs right there in Little Lagoon. And, they, you know, it's kind of, you could see their grocery store. And that's what this was.
So we're going to run to the break here. Hold on, and we'll come back because I want to ask a lot more questions about this. And, you know, you report here the canal was about 30 feet wide and 6 feet deep. And we'll talk about how it ended
serious
up.
Serious canal, right?
I mean, serious canal. And I want to figure out how that went away. And I got a bunch more questions for a lot of folks interested in this. Coming right back, more with Ben Raines from AL.com. We are live at the Mobile Boat Show. Come see us.
You're listening to Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Welcome back, FM Talk 106.5, and it is Midday Mobile live for the Mobile Boat Show. Here's how it works. So we're here for the next half hour or so with the show, and then we'll be here throughout the evening for the Guides Corner, tomorrow all day with the Guides Corner, Sunday all day with the Guides Corner, and also tomorrow from 10 to noon in the slot where we normally have the Midday Replay, where we're going to be doing a two-hour on-location live FM Talk 106.5 outdoors broadcast. So Mike Ward and I, who's here, come by and see Mike. Mike and I'll do that show tomorrow from 10 to noon, and we have a plethora of guests, many of our guides, our featured guides from the Guides Corner, but all kind of guests, you know, with the new information out on Alabama snapper season this year, and I've got, oh, I don't know, a laundry list of other questions about the about what's happening in 2019 with the fisheries. We'll be joined by Director of Alabama Marine Resources, Scott Bannon. He'll be here tomorrow. I've got a lot of people booked on the show, so if you'd like to, first of all, check it out on the radio, but we'd love for you to come out and be here in person. We do that show as they open up the doors tomorrow, starting at 10 to noon tomorrow. All right, and continue our conversation with my buddy Ben Raines from AL.com, and talking about a story, if you didn't catch it already, you can go for a quick search of AL.com, or just, I bet, go to Ben Raines' social media post, and you can get a link to his story about a, how old is this canal? 14 years? What is it?
Yeah, 1,400, 1,400 years. Colombian artifact. There you go.
It is. And so, and this is, people in Gulf Shores, I know I've gotten texts and talked to people and heard these stories in the past, and they're nodding along with me, that they always talked about the Indian Mounds and the Indian Ditch. And I had heard it, but I'm kind of a West Sider and spend my time on Dolphin Island and had just heard about it, never really explored it. This is part of the folklore that has now been proven by the science.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there are signs all around us. I mean, Dolphin Island, you know, the mounds you see there.
Sure.
There are a bunch of shell mounds in Grand Bay and even, you know, Portersville Bay. They're all over the Delta. I mean, I find new shell middens all the time. When you see that white shell along the shoreline.
Sure.
So, you know, the native peoples had a huge presence here. And clearly, you know, they were shaping this landscape 1,400 years ago and probably 5,000 years ago. You know, that canal, you just have to imagine there were a whole lot more of them. You know, if they were capable of building that, they would have altered the environment to suit them all kind of ways, I'm sure.
I mean, it is amazing that any trace, and the pictures in your story show where you can see this depression in the wetlands where you have the filled-in canal. But you got to ask, with the change of the environment, I mean, how many hurricanes had happened in 1,400
yeah.
years? How many just coverings and uncoverings? We'll talk about things like, y'all got to check out Ben's documentary on the underwater forest, among other things. I mean, the only thing that stays the same is change, right? I mean, so that there's enough to be able to even find this
well,
and excavate it.
You bring up the underwater forest. The fact is, sea level would have been very different 1,400 years ago. And
that,
you know, we know that 2,000 years ago, Fort Morgan, that beach there, was a swamp with cypress trees growing on it. It was not the Gulf Beach. So, you know, even having these canals connected, they still would have had to go a little further to get all the way to the salty water.
Now, you mentioned this might have been one, or probably was one of multiple canals, but in reading your reporting, that this, as the find, as the excavation, is pretty much alone other than some that have been excavated in Florida, and it's not like they were in Okaloosa County. These other canals were in Central and South Florida, right?
Right, and you know, there are a couple of things to remember there. One, there are a lot of shorter canals that are all over the place. This one was significant because it was, you know, 0.6 mile long, which was a lot of work. It's a lot different than making a 20 or 30 foot canal, you know, and there are plenty of those kind of shorter ones around, or 100 feet or whatever. This was a major undertaking. And then you have to think there were more that we probably haven't discovered, because they fill in and they just look like a low spot, a gully, you know, that you'd see walking in the woods. They believe there's another canal on Mound Island in the Delta. And they're going to start trying to investigate that and see if they can locate it. We may discover, you know, a teeming metropolis that sat here 1,500 years ago. Who knows?
Well, if you had to move weight back then and you had the choice of floating it or carrying it, yeah, I would have floated it. But I tell you, the 0.6 mile thing is really an eye-opener, like you said. And I'm trying to understand. You're right here. It appears the canal was about 30 feet wide and 6 feet deep. The two bodies of water connected, Oyster Bay and Little Lagoon, would have been both rich fishing grounds in 600 A.D. Why? Why 30 feet? I mean, I can think, once again, just kind of my general sense of how a pre-Columbian period would do that. I would make it...
It would have had tidal flow.
That's what I was thinking. The exact same. Did they start it and then Mother Nature take over and make it bigger?
I would imagine. You know, you see what happens in the marsh when you open up a cut.
Yep.
It just gets bigger and bigger, and that's where Louisiana, you know, Louisiana disappeared. All those cuts just kept, you know, wind-driven waves working back and forth, and then tidal currents. And, you know, this, if you open up Mobile Bay to the Gulf of Mexico, even if there's, you know, these two little ponds in the way, Little Lagoon and Oyster Bay, if you make a current channel there where that tide can move back and forth, it's going to move, and it's going to eat earth away. So it may have been much smaller when they started.
Well, that's what I was wondering when I saw, you know, I read that. It said 30 feet wide and 6 feet deep. I said, there would be no reason to go through the work to make it that big. You just needed it to have the size to float the dugout canoe and whatever you were hauling in it. And then I started to think about the erosion, which I learned, you know, I don't have a degree in hydrology, but I played in the sand and the mud as a child, or even into my late 20s, and played with water and watched what it did. And that's exactly right. But then also the inverse I've seen over time, watching channels form and unform and different kind of deltas and a Birdfoot delta and all that. You'll see, like, when it's a small channel, it'll start to, you know, have water force through there and start to carve itself out and get bigger and bigger until it seems like it gets to a point that the water moves more slowly. Now, in this case, you have tidal action, but it moves more slowly, and then it starts kind of reversing and getting shallower.
Yeah, and it that may have happened here. That may be how it ended up so wide, you know, some sort of mechanism like that, where it was, the sides were caving in, and they kept having to dig them out and ended up with kind of a shallower, broader thing. But, you know, I wonder if there are canals in places we live today that are covered up in pavement and things. You know, you'd have to think, if you go see this, and it's across from a Henrietta Fulford place, I think, you can walk, you know, there's a right-of-way there, a sewer right-of-way.
Is there a way we can get to it? Is that people can, without trespassing, can they get to see parts of this?
I believe so. I got there, and I don't think I was trespassing, but I'm not positive. So if you do go, it's not my fault if you get arrested. But I think it's okay.
Okay. So, and you say there are other ones. Is there any technology that was used in the discovery of this one that's now something that could be implemented on a broader scale to find these, or is it just like we were talking about, just some folklore knowledge of saying here's a close place, here's a likely place.
They're actually going to do exactly what you're talking about. They're going to use LIDAR, which is a radar you shoot from the air, and it can detect minute changes in the height of the ground. So they're planning to do that to find where it came out of Oyster Bay. They're going to, you know, scan that way, and you can do that over huge land masses. This is a really, you know, it's a sweeping tool you can use from outer space, And they did that in Central and South America and have found a lot of new ruins down there purely by looking at these images shot from above, which is really fascinating.
It is, so, absolutely. I mean, I can't wait to, you know, like you said, how many of them were we going to find if we've been living on top of this series of canals right here, you know, in somebody's backyard?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, people have shell mounds in their yards. You know, go to Spanish Fork. Those hotels where you cross the causeway and the Hampton Inn and all those on the eastern shore, immediately when you come off the causeway, those are built on giant shell mounds.
I never knew. The ones there, it's not down on the causeway, up on the hill.
Right, right. So if you turn off the causeway and head into Daphne.
Sure. I know the one you're talking about.
The Hampton Inn. Yeah, it's on and it was apparently very controversial when they built it. I wasn't here when that happened, but it is a shell mound. You can go find the signs now.
All right.
I find ancient pottery all the time around here. There's spots I go in the Delta, and it is nothing to find 200 pieces of pottery in 5 minutes. And, you know, you have to leave it there. You're not allowed to take it. But, you know, these spots I'm talking about, I think were actually pottery factories where they were building pottery for more than the family, you know, to trade. And they're near big clay banks and stuff. You start to see this area as this, you know, it wasn't a modern city, but it was teeming with people who were trading with other people and growing things and catching things and bartering. You know, it's really cool, really neat window here to our past.
It is, and I tell you what, I want people. I got just a couple minutes here left with you, and I got one more series of questions. And you got fans coming by here asking me questions for you, so I'm going to get to that. But remind folks too, they can go out with you and learn about this thing and get the clay in their hands, get their hands dirty, and look at this if they choose to. You take tours of these places.
Oh yeah, absolutely. In fact, on my Lower Delta tours, we always stop and look at some old Indian sites and find some pottery. That's part of the program, unless it's all underwater. But I was actually realizing I should have been at the boat show with a booth.
That's right.
But yeah, absolutely. The charters are going on. Best way to get in touch with me for them is probably through Facebook, and you can scroll through my old posts and see descriptions of different trips and see pictures from recent trips and stuff. You know, March, April, May is my absolute favorite time around here. And, you know, the Lower Delta, if you've never seen it during that window, you should. It's spectacular. We have hundreds of species of birds coming through. You know, the gators are out, and then the flowers. And, you know, April, when you're up there in a meadow that's, you know, you're looking at 100 acres of blooming lilies and, you know, the Delta lilies and purple iris, it's just breathtaking. You can't believe this is where you live.
I tell you what, we've gone to less than a minute here, but I've got to get this answer. Can you give us a very quick version of where we are with the Clotilda search? You had talked a little bit with us a couple weeks ago. Where's that stand?
So right now, all we know is that it's exactly the right size. The state is telling me that the previous excavation is over, and they are kind of in a holding pattern, awaiting what they're going to do next. When I was up there, I heard the archaeologists, they were planning to dredge it out, but they were scared to because they were afraid the structure inside would fall over on them. So I think they're going to go back and do, you know, they were talking about this being more industrial diving, which means, you know, hard hats and all that kind of stuff. I think they may drain the thing out, build a cofferdam around it even to look at it.
Let's do this.
Its identity is still unknown, but it is still the exact length and width of the Clotilda.
Ben Raines,
exactly,
thank you so very much.
We're supposed to be burnt.
Ben, thanks. We'll talk about this more next week. We got to jump. We're live at the boat show right here on Midday Mobile.
All right, have fun.
You're listening to Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5. Call Sean now at 343-0106.
Welcome back. Midday Mobile on FM Talk 106.5. And great to have a new friend back in studio, Ruth Lichtenfeld from Taylor Martino. Thanks for coming back.
Hey, thank you for having me.
And, you know, last time we were talking about your portion of the team at Taylor Martino, that you come in as a non-traditional student.
Yes.
Getting your law degree after working as a registered nurse for some decades.
Yes.
Right. And you decide you're the person, we've all made that promise that one day, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to go back to school. I'm going to do this. I'm going to get this degree. You're the person that did it.
I am.
Thank you. You make the ratio look a little bit better out there for those who promise to do this. So you go and you finish law school in 2.5 years. But I think about this now, looking at the news, obviously, big case for the nation, big case here in the state of Alabama, and the discussion of opioid and opioid addiction. And you come in as part of the team with Taylor Martino with that time as a registered nurse, that time of working in the medical world with a physician. And you see it from a perspective that's not just over the last couple of years. You've been watching this story develop for decades.
Yes, that's correct. I was the office manager and nurse for my husband's practice out at Providence for 28 years. And I remember specifically in the 90s, drug reps would come by and try to convince my husband that OxyContin was not addictive and that he should use it, put patients on it 24 hours a day for what we call post-op pain, which can be really severe pain, but it's self-limiting. It's not the kind of pain you would treat. And my husband was a very, very, very astute physician. And I remember he would say every time, OxyContin is for cancer patients. But these companies had a massive marketing campaign. And then they kind of turned up the heat. And then one of the physicians in Mobile, who now is in federal prison for inappropriate prescribing of opioids and other crimes for which he was committed, he came by himself a couple of times because he was working as a representative of one of the big companies, and he would try to convince my husband that he should prescribe opioids around the clock for routine pain or for chronic back pain. And my husband was just smarter than that, actually.
What you're saying, though, is not only sales reps coming in for these products, but they recruited other physicians to come talk physician to physician to convince them that they should be prescribing these more often.
And I don't mean to imply that physicians who took that narrative, the false narrative we call it, that OxyContin and other opioids are not addictive. It's just he didn't succumb to the pressure.
But there was pressure.
Oh my gosh, tremendous pressure in a very, very sophisticated marketing way. One rep would come by and he said, oh, I'm going to bring you a catered lunch every single week. And I'm like, no, thank you. I don't really.
Because you knew it was time to.
Well, it was inappropriate because then they expect you to write a bunch of prescriptions. But then another time the rep said, well, I'm going to bring you this fancy candy. I'm going to fill it up every time it gets low. I mean, just things. To me, that's sophisticated marketing.
And that's some real-world experience that sets you apart from so many others here. Your years as RN, seeing this firsthand, and now being part of the team at Taylor Martino that's representing hospitals against these drug manufacturers, the distributors, the ones that were coming by with the full-on press to prescribe this stuff.
Right. And that's just one example of what was going on across the whole country, and it went on for a long time. But in my work at Taylor Martino, I visited 13 different hospitals throughout the country, and I've heard from...
Stories the same?
They are the same. They are heartbreaking and compelling about what the opioid epidemic has done to their communities, the financial strain on the healthcare facilities, the loss of life. I mean,
yeah, look at the stats. I mean, daily.
Over 115 people every single day are dying from opioid addiction. It's from the overdose of that. But there are just literally hundreds of thousands of people who are addicted to opioids who haven't overdosed, but they're still addicted. And it all began with the false narrative that, oh, just like with my husband, even though that's a very small example, just put him on OxyContin 24 hours a day, you know, for post-op pain for a couple of weeks. Well, it doesn't take long to get addicted to opioids. And it's a very, very, very tragic epidemic. And it's killing more people every day. You know, we have to do something. Taylor Martino lawyers, especially Steve Martino, who's the lead attorney in our firm for the case, I mean, they're just passionate about helping people and stemming the tide of the epidemic. And that's what we're working on. And we're working on it, you know, a lot and very, very hard.
Now, Ruth, we're getting an education here, too, because I think for a lot of people, there was this building scourge and all of a sudden this was a big issue with the addiction to opioids. But you're taking us back and kind of saying, here's how it started. Here's what was going on. Because it did for a lot of people that kind of woke up one day and said, holy cow, there's all these people addicted to this. This is a big issue. Mm-hmm. But unless we were on the front lines like you were, we don't know kind of how this started, how the story was written up to the point that it became a national news story.
I remember it literally it was yesterday, and it went on for months and months until they gave up on my husband. But the significance is that the marketing was very, very sophisticated. It was the false narrative and the companies, you know, they spread that false narrative across the country.
And this is when you represent the hospitals against these drug manufacturers and distributors, I guess this is what you're saying, is that this full-on press from these companies is why the scourge exists today.
And we contend that they knew it was addictive, that they knew it was a false narrative, but they did it for profit.
Right. One of the questions here, too, though, is that these weren't brand new. The opioids, they were prescribed. Like you said, your husband had said, well, these are for cancer drugs. So they did exist, right? So what changed? At one point, they went from being specifically, is it for end of life or things like that, to then being
palliative care for cancer patients or people with intractable pain.
And somehow then it became not a panacea, but a drug for, at least they were pushing for a lot more reasons, right, than they took it to Main Street.
Healthcare professionals are advocates for the people who are suffering. And so everyone wants to relieve suffering of their patients. Physicians want to do that. And so if you have this false narrative that's so convincing and so compelling that you can alleviate your patient's suffering by using, you know, opioids, and that they're not addictive, why wouldn't you do that?
You've been told by the reps.
Convinced,
not addictive.
Yes. Told, taught, seminars were given. I mean, it wasn't just a drug rep. You would, because you want to help them. Physicians are in the practice of medicine to help people and alleviate suffering. And why wouldn't you do that? Of course you would. But it was based on the false narrative that the drug companies and distributors promoted.
Wow. What a story. Ruth Lichtenfeld from Taylor Martino, thank you for being with us today. Thanks for the information, and I hope to get you back here soon.
Thank you. I would love to come back. Thank you very much.
All right. Ruth Lichtenfeld with Taylor Martino right here on Midday Mobile.
No representation is made that legal services performed are greater than the quality of legal services of others.